The Hypnotic Swarm. The power of conversational hypnosis lies in the fact that the subject doesn't know that you are a hypnotist, and more often than not, he won't know how to counter the various techniques that hypnotists employ to achieve their desired outcomes. To bolster your personal power as a hypnotist, I am also going to share with you covert strategies in conversational hypnosis that you can use any time to improve your chances of success. These techniques are almost undetectable by ordinary folks, and you can use them in combination with the other techniques that I have already shared with you. Tactic number one. The first covert tactic that I would like to share with you is utilizing the principle of reversed effect. The principle of reversed effect is really quite easy to remember. The more you try to accomplish something, the more likely that you will not be able to do it. This principle might sound a little strange at first because I've been encouraging everyone to try different techniques throughout this book. But please, do stay with me until the end of this section so we can thoroughly explore what the principle of reversed effect can truly do for you as a budding conversational hypnotist. Now, the first thing that people usually ask me about this principle is, why is it so? Why are people bound to fail at something if they really think about it as they try to do it? The answer lies in the nature of the two halves of the human mind and the natures of these two halves. The human mind has two halves, the conscious half and the subconscious half. So far, we have focused on very specific facets of these two halves. You now know that the conscious mind is responsible for filtering the information that comes in so that the subconscious mind would be protected from potentially polluting stimuli. You also know now that the conscious mind is almost always alert, but it can be put to sleep through hypnotic techniques. What you didn't know about these two halves is just how dependent the whole mind is on the subconscious mind. You see, the subconscious mind is more than just the seat of your emotions and creativity or imagination. It is actually responsible for all the complex skills that you already have internalized. It is responsible for all the background computations that make it possible for people to perform actions without worrying that they will forget something while they are doing these actions. If this model of the human mind seems a little muddled, I want you to think back to a time when you were learning something new. This could have happened when you were a child or fairly recently, if you tried to learn a new skill. Do you remember how hard the new skill was in the beginning? For example, most people remember how hard it was to tie their shoelaces when they were just learning how to do it. Another example would be when a person tries to learn how to play a musical instrument. There is a lot of rote memorization and errors involved in the beginning. But as a person works on the new skill, everything seems to click into place. The person no longer feels that he is performing something difficult. Rather, the activity feels completely natural, and it's nothing new. What does this reveal about the subconscious mind? It shows how the subconscious mind is able to create efficient shortcuts for you so that you won't have to consciously think about certain things anymore. When you need to do something that requires a lot of details and a lot of steps, the conscious mind is a poor partner. Why? Because the conscious mind was designed to handle only a few bits of information at a time. According to recent studies, the conscious mind can only handle an average of 7 bits of information at any one time. If a person is really interested in what he is looking at, he can probably note up to 9 separate bits of information. If he is bored, then the number drops to 5 or less. That is how inefficient the conscious mind can be when it comes to juggling information. Because of its inherent weakness in handling large numbers of information, the mind turns over the responsibility of processing information to the subconscious mind, which has a much larger, almost infinite, capacity to process and retain information for later use. So let's apply this new knowledge to the idea of performing something consciously. When the subconscious mind is suspended and the conscious mind takes over a particular effort, the required action becomes more complicated than it really is. For example, have you tried driving to any location while thinking of all the individual steps needed to operate your car and drive safely? Probably not, because the whole activity would become too complicated. No one drives around thinking, I have to push the gear stick here, then I press the brake, I press the gas again, press the brake yet again. If people did this, we would probably see a dramatic rise in car crashes across the country. When this knowledge is correlated with the principle of reversed effect, it is easy to see how primal the principle is to human life. When someone thinks of doing something and the activity itself lingers in the conscious mind eventually gives up because of the strain and the subconscious mind kicks in. This is what usually happens when a person tries to consciously control his eating. A person usually ends up thinking of what not to do, and that becomes unbearable. And the subconscious mind just kicks in and says, "Stop that, and just have some chocolates." The discipline at eating should be internalized from the beginning so that the dieter won't have to use his conscious faculty to achieve the desired result. Because if he sticks to his conscious faculty, he is bound to fail, because the conscious mind is almost always a hindrance when it comes to performing something smoothly and efficiently. The principle of reversed effect is a favorite among stage hypnotists who perform small suggestibility tests to ensure that the subject is primed and ready for hypnosis. What stage hypnotists usually do is say things like, "I want you to resist me with all your might, so you would be able to do whatever." The hypnotist then performs a simple induction technique like the hand clasp induction, and the hypnotic trance is suddenly manifested. Why are people unable to resist a hypnotist even when he has openly challenged a subject? Simple. The task of resisting the hypnotist has suddenly been shifted to the conscious mind. So instead of letting the subconscious mind do its work, the conscious mind is called upon to handle the present challenge. And invariably, the conscious mind fails, and this in turn confirms the hypnotist's assumption that the subject is indeed in trance and is ready for hypnotic suggestions. If you are ready to use the principle of reversed effect in your own conversations, here are some basic steps that you can use to activate it. First, use the word "try" when you want to challenge your subject. Statements like, "Try it, I already did," imply that the task itself is impossible or extremely difficult. The difficulty or impossibility of the task is projected to your subject, and he takes it as his own truth. And because his conscious mind will try to make sure that he succeeds, the task itself becomes doubly difficult, if not impossible. The more he thinks about what he should do to accomplish the task, the higher his risk of failure. Here's a sample hypnotic script. As you stare at the swinging pendulum, you will suddenly feel that your eyes are becoming heavier and heavier. Heavier and heavier with sleep. And as you continue staring at the pendulum, you will try to fight the sleepiness. Try to keep your eyes open as I swing the pendulum. Deeper and deeper. More and more relaxed. Your eyes will feel heavy and will try to close, but don't close them. Try to keep them open. Second, identify an unconscious or internalized process, and then begin piling different statements that invoke the principle of reversed effect. Remember, the process has to be an internalized one. The subject has to become confused before you can start using your strategically crafted statements. Tactic number 2. The second covert tactic that I'd like to give you is actively divert the subject's resistance. So far, we have been studying the different ways that you can use your personal power to overcome the subject's own personal power. Because of this basic setup, it is easy to fall into the trap of entering a continuous power struggle with your subject. Power struggles are a fact of life in our modern age. Power is everywhere, and if you don't know how to tap into your own personal power, other people are going to reap the benefits of influencing others. However, when an interaction is based purely on the idea of overcoming someone's personal power, there are some repercussions that you may have to deal with later on. For one, the subject may begin to feel that something is wrong with him because you have been able to make him comply so easily before. He might feel bad that he has become so suggestible. Little does he know that he is talking to a hypnotist. When your subject starts feeling all these conflicting thoughts and emotions about complying with you, it's as if the seeds that you've sown before will begin to wilt. The subject may stop all the passive feedback that he has been giving you because somehow what he has been doing was not able to give him control of the situation. This is the focal point of our discussion now, control. So far, I have shown you how to take control of situations and people with words, tonalities, and actions. But what happens when the subject begins showing signs that he wants to take control of the situation? Do you fight your subject, or do you let him have his way? The answer is neither. You must not directly fight with your subject because that will only lead to more resistance. And you cannot give him the reins because that will probably undo all of the hard work that you have put into the interaction in the first place. What should a hypnotist do to traverse this difficult and unpredictable terrain? The solution to this problem is simple. Instead of fighting your subject's resistance, begin diverting it. You might be thinking, how in the world does one divert resistance? Well, think of resistance as essentially the manifestation of another person's personal energy. When resistance begins to build up within your subject's psyche, and he is unable to release that energy will begin to force its way out. And when it finally explodes, the subject might walk away from you. How can a hypnotist divert a strong negative energy like resistance? The easiest way to do this is by giving your subject multiple options and offers. We can take a page from the book of veteran car salesmen. Car salesmen who specialize in selling cars to even the most resistant of people often use this technique without realizing it. Instead of just offering one thing over and over again to the subject, they begin adding stuff to their offer. However, the other things that they are offering the subject are merely decoys. If the subject resists these other offers, the resistance would have zero effect on the target outcome of the salesman. For example, a car salesman might offer the buyer the same car with a different color. The subject will begin to channel his resistance to the idea of buying a green car over a blue one. But in the end, he's still buying the blue car. The more resistance you can divert, the more the subject will feel that he is in full control of the situation, and the more suggestible he becomes. This principle might sound strange in the beginning, but as you apply it to your own social interactions, you will soon find out that as long as a person feels that he has at least a little control of the situation, he feels empowered, and his mental state becomes more supportive of the speaker. Tactic number 3. The third covert tactic that you can use is diverting the subject's attention away from your hypnotic suggestions. Too often, hypnotists encounter difficulty getting their main message across because the message itself gets blocked by the subject's conscious filters. It's like trying to throw a dart outdoors on a windy day. The dart is precise, but if other factors like wind direction and wind intensity are working against it, it will not hit its mark. You can continue throwing your darts, but if the conditions do not change, it will take a long time before you hit your intended marks. To avoid this problem, you can divert your subject's attention away from your darts or hypnotic suggestions. Since the main goal is for you to implant hypnotic suggestions into your subject's subconscious mind, your messages have to be able to bypass the conscious filters. Now, I know that I've shared many techniques in other parts of this book that can be used to achieve the exact same result. But I am sharing yet another technique with you, so if the other techniques do not work, you have a fallback plan. Also, this technique is more advanced because we are not going to give the conscious mind any opportunity to process and potentially block our hypnotic message. At this point in time, we are no longer interested in putting the conscious mind to sleep, so you can really start piling your hypnotic suggestions. I'm going to teach you a method that will allow you to completely bypass the conscious side of the mind, so you can gain access to the vulnerable subconscious mind. Bypassing the conscious mind is so critical to your success because the conscious mind has a well-devised system of analyzing information. And more often than not, it rejects more than it accepts information. So instead of putting your hypnotic suggestions at risk, we're going to drive down the risk completely. There are two basic steps needed to divert your subject's attention away from your hypnotic suggestions. Of course, you would still need to tell the subject what you want to take place. But there lies the problem. Once the hypnotic suggestion is out in the open, it becomes vulnerable to attacks from the conscious mind of the subject. You can go around this problem by performing two crucial steps. The first step is to just casually mention what you want the subject to say, think, or do. This is the hypnotic implantation phase. By casually mentioning the hypnotic suggestion, you are directly sowing the seeds that will later take root in the subject's subconscious mind. It's easy to sow the seeds, but it's difficult to stop an alert conscious mind from uprooting the hypnotic suggestions that you have just sown. And so we move on to the second crucial step. Distract your subject immediately after you have given your hypnotic suggestion. The distraction has to be performed immediately. The timing has to be precise so that you can block the subject's train of thought. Because once your subject starts scrutinizing the hypnotic suggestion that you have given, he can continue resisting you until the end of the conversation. Essentially, you will be giving a pair of ideas every time you implant a hypnotic suggestion. The first idea is the hypnotic suggestion itself, while the second idea is just a decoy that your subject can scrutinize all he wants, so that the hypnotic suggestion can safely reach the subject's subconscious mind without being mangled by conscious mental filters. As your subject tackles and grapples the second idea, the hypnotic suggestion will anchor into the subject's mind, and it will slowly grow inside the subject's mind. Because the idea has already reached the subconscious, it will be nourished and protected by the person. Why? It has already bypassed the usual filters, and the subject will feel that the hypnotic suggestion is legitimate and reasonable. The best thing about this technique is that the subject won't have any chance to create feedback or input regarding the hypnotic suggestion. His critical faculty is literally suspended for a few moments, and the hypnotic suggestion is able to take flight without being tackled. Here's an example to get you started. Remember when you were learning how to drive? You were nervous at first, but you were able to overcome those emotions to become a great driver. There were all these things that you had to do, like remember when to switch gears and press the gas. You also had to negotiate turns and inclines, which are the most difficult skills in driving. Note how I left a hypnotic message in that cluster of statements before I switched the topic so that the subject would forget what I have just said. The seed has been planted, and so I would only have to wait for it to grow inside the person's mind so that later on he would adapt it as his own belief. And he won't remember that I was the real source of the belief. Here are some more techniques to implant hypnotic suggestions covertly. First, the easiest way is to simply modify the topic in your conversation. This can be done almost instantly in most cases, even if you are in a lecture room full of students. As long as you remember how to shift smoothly from one idea to another, you will be able to do this effectively without raising suspicion from your audience. 2. You can also prime your subject by piling different suggestions on top of each other. You implant the main suggestion and proceed to give the subject a variety of other suggestions so he can tackle those ideas. 3. Give the subject 5 or 6 different ideas at a time, so he forgets the main idea that you were sharing. However, the ideas that you are giving should at least be parallel to the main idea that you started with. This way, the subject would still pay attention to your other ideas. If your ideas sound too strange or off-topic, they will probably be ignored by your subject, and he will turn his attention once again to the main hypnotic suggestion. The Art of the Unspoken. So far in our discussion of conversational hypnosis, we have focused intently on verbal strategies to influence others. Improving your mastery of verbal techniques is crucial to your growth as a conversational hypnotist, because language is the recognized center of all human communication. It is the formal basis of social interactions. But as you may already know, verbal language is just 30% or less of what is really being communicated by people when they decide to interact with others. The rest of the message, if you will, is expressed through vocal language, tonality, and nonverbal language, body language. What is really important to human communication, its crux, is the unspoken language that we all speak. Nonverbal language is not limited by a person's ability to speak any language. It is not limited by a person's education and the culture that he had grown up in. Body language is universal, and as such, it is extremely vital that you become aware of how it works and how you can take advantage of it. Nonverbal language, body language, has several important uses for a conversational hypnotist. It allows the hypnotist to study the subject from afar. It shows the hypnotist what the subject is really thinking and feeling at that exact moment in time. It is a unique and empowering tool for establishing rapport. Nonverbal language allows a hypnotist to detect deceit during a conversation or dialogue. Are you ready to learn more about nonverbal language and how you can use it to maximize your power as a conversational hypnotist? Here are my most important pointers regarding nonverbal language that you should never forget when you are interacting with your subjects in any situation. First, a person's breathing rate and breathing pattern are extremely accurate indicators during a conversation. If your subject is comfortable and just relaxed in your presence, his breathing pattern would be constant and his breathing rate would also be quite slow. A relaxed person would also breathe easily from the diaphragm and not the chest, although this might vary from person to person. When a person begins breathing too quickly, that is a sign that he is experiencing negative emotions like anxiety or even anger. If you are just starting to establish rapport with your subject, and he exhibits a significant change in his breathing pattern or rate, that may mean that he is not comfortable with what you are saying, or he is not comfortable with the interaction at all. Since trust is extremely vital to the success of a conversational hypnotist, you must adapt quickly if your subject is expressing negative feedback. It does not really matter what your subject says. If your subject is expressing non-verbally that he does not trust you, then that is what he is really thinking at the moment. Of course, it is still imperative that you read nonverbal signals based on their context. For example, if you are conversing in a small room with a subject who is claustrophobic, then this condition might be the cause of hyperventilation or any strange changes in your subject's breathing pattern. Try to determine the simple causes of the changes in your subject's gestures and general behavior before making a conclusion. This will save you from a lot of mistakes down the road. Now, you can also use your subject's breathing pattern and breathing rate to pace and lead him. The trick here is to determine the consistent breathing rhythm first and then imitate it for a short while. It does not matter if your subject is breathing fast or slow, just match his breathing rhythm. The moment you are able to capture the consistent breathing rhythm of your subject, you can begin matching it. You will match the subject's breathing rhythm because similarity breeds trust. By expressing a simple yet very essential similarity, the subject will begin to see you as a friendly figure, someone that he can talk to and trust. 2. When you are speaking to another person, always remember to establish proper eye contact to express your genuine interest in what the other person is saying. You see, the number one dialogue destroyer is not a person's knowledge or lack thereof, it's how a person listens to the speaker. If you appear disinterested and bored with the other person, your subject will have no further reason to continue. The interaction will become strained, and rapport will be dissolved as time passes. The simplest and most effective way to show that you are interested in what your subject is saying is by making eye contact. Now, this is the tricky part. In most societies, too much eye contact is frowned upon because the eyes are just too private and expressive. So the challenge here is to make just the right amount of eye contact to show your subject that you are listening to everything he is saying 100% of the time. In addition to making eye contact, it won't hurt to visualize that the person in front of you is a family member or a dear friend of yours. By imagining yourself in a different reality with a different person, you can eliminate stress, anxiety, and boredom from the situation. Of course, you must be firmly grounded in the fact that you are talking to someone and you have a goal to accomplish. But again, it won't hurt if you imagine things that will help you express genuine interest in the other person. 3. The next set of nonverbal signals that you should pay attention to is your subject's facial expressions. Now, we're not just interested in frowns and smiles here. The human face has so many muscles, and these muscles are firing all the time, depending on what the subject is feeling, thinking, or experiencing at the moment. The human face is capable of conveying dozens of unique sentiments and emotions, and not all of them are immediately apparent. You have to be sensitive of the micro-signals or micro-expressions that are usually centered on the eyes, nose, and mouth. Micro-expressions are usually unconscious signals. This means the subject has little or no control over them. When you are reading another person's facial expressions, it would be helpful if you can combine and interpret all current signals as a whole. Reading another person's body language is a lot like understanding verbal language. You cannot just take individual signals at face value and say, "Hey, this is what the other person is really saying." If I said orange out of the blue, it could really mean anything, right? The same principle applies to body language, too. You have to reconstruct and approximate the actual message in your mind by collecting all of the current signals emanating from the subject. You have to form a complete statement from the current signals, and once you have that statement in your mind, that would be the time to formulate a good response or to take action if you think you are losing your subject in the conversation. Now, I get this question a lot. How much weight should you give to smiles? In my own experience, a lot. Why? The human smile is not something that is learned in school or even at home. It is instinctual. When a gesture or expression is instinctual, that means it lies below the threshold of the conscious, rational mind. It is extremely close to the subconscious mind, the seat of a person's true emotions, thoughts, and drives. When a person smiles, he can be expressing a variety of things. But the one thing you have to determine first before you can assign any real interpretation is whether the smile you have received is genuine or fake. This might not be surprising at all, since you have probably seen someone give a fake smile. So my job now is to guide you in determining the genuineness of a smile. The only real indicator that a smile is genuine is the eyes. The eyes are extremely expressive portents on the facial region, and very few people have the ability to control what they express through their eyes. The muscles controlling the eyes and muscles surrounding the eyes fire even if the subject doesn't want them to fire. When a person is really happy or positive about something, his eyes smile along with his lips. The person's whole face will light up because all of the muscles on the cheeks and near the eyes are all relaxed. A fake smile takes effort. A person who is wearing a fake smile usually has to scrunch his whole face just to pull up his lips. Also, a fake smile doesn't activate the eyes. A person who is secretly unimpressed with you will have bored, emotionless eyes. The smile becomes irrelevant because the eyes and the whole face exhibits what the subject is really thinking of at the present time. 4. Let's talk about how you should approach a person. Normally, people love interacting with other people who have the right amount of confidence. Is it possible to exude this confidence even when you are just physically approaching a person for the first time? Yes. The key is actually your position in relation to the subject. There are three positions that you should be aware of when you are approaching another person. The first position is from the side. This positioning is actually a poor choice because the subject has to turn his head before he can clearly see you. This positioning is interpreted by many as a sign of low self-confidence. You are approaching from the side because you are not that confident that the other person will notice you. The second position is slightly in front of the person. So just imagine moving in front of the person a few degrees. You are not directly in front of the person, but you are not completely approaching from the left or right. This is the ideal positioning. It gives the subject enough room to be comfortable with you, but at the same time, it allows you to express just the right amount of confidence. This positioning is equalizing, too. So the subject will view you as an equal or someone who is potentially of a higher stature because you chose to be visible but not completely straightforward when you approached. The last positioning is directly in front of another person. This is not really recommended because it activates the unconscious fight or flight instinct. So regardless of your intent, your subject will feel a twinge of defensiveness and alarm at your approach because you are coming in directly from the front.